This is the Saxo Market Call, daily insights on what is moving the financial markets.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Wednesday, 8th of June, 2022. Markets snapping back from a little breakdown through some support levels. The local range in the NASDAQ 100 future, for example, in the U.S. yesterday breaking lower below the 12,450 odd level yesterday, and we closed the day stronger. There's some heavy options expiry this week. I don't know if some of it is related to that, but it was a positive session given that we tried to break lower and couldn't. But I don't know if we have any really information value in this session yesterday. I think it did help probably as well that we saw U.S. yields, Treasury yields consolidating a bit lower. But the headlines are a bit few and far between here, Peter.
I would say that it was an encouraging session in the sense that if we had closed below the support levels at 12,455 that we mentioned yesterday, it would definitely have been a negative sign for the market, potentially to go low and test that opening print from the Friday's rally 10 days ago. But instead, we came back quite forcibly, and we closed with a higher close than the prior day. And I think we are now smack in the consolidation zone that seems to be established since the rebound. So I think in the short term, this was obviously positive for technology stocks. A lot of the sentiment was really in the smaller companies. So you see in our theme baskets that next gen medicine bubble stocks were really the big drivers yesterday, together with cybersecurity and gaming stocks. You had the mega caps around where the MSCI World was. So it was not your Facebook, it was not your Microsoft or Google, et cetera, Tesla driving the show here. So encouraging. And then I stumbled across this comment. I think it's the front page article right now on FT. Trafigura warns oil prices could reach parabolic state in threat to economy. Talks about how Russia has just left a gapping hole in the oil market. And I think it's a lead into you, Ole, because, I mean, from my part on equities, as long as we have such an energy situation as we have right now, you know, you have Ukraine's president yesterday saying that they're going to do export bans on coal and natural gas because they want to preserve reserves for their own winter, which is going to be the harshest, as they say, since the independence. So, I mean, this is a red flag for me. I don't know what you're saying, Ole.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was just also highlighted by the EIA yesterday in their short-term energy outlook. For this month, they basically raised the risk that Russian production could be 18% lower towards the end of 2023. And if we don't see a corresponding drop in global demand, then obviously the competition for crude from refineries around the world to supply its consumers will continue to be very, very elevated. And that's also, I think that remains the key focus in the market, that with China reopening, we simply at one point are forced to see prices move to the levels where demand destruction starts to kick in. But at the same time, I think everyone, at least a lot of people around the world, they still feel that they've got some savings pent up over the past couple of years of lockdown. So they are kind of at this point immune to these rises. They definitely want to go on their holiday. They want to burn the fuel that's required for that to happen. And that basically means we need to get probably into the autumn months before we start to see any significant potential impact on global demand. And that really is the only thing that can square the dots right now, that we see demand start to adjust to a lower supply outlook.
On slide five, you got some thoughts there on, especially on the inventory side. We saw the API last night, was it? And we have, or is that tonight?
We had the API last night, and they actually went a little bit against the expectations, especially if we look at crude stocks. That's the top right table there. API showed a 1.8 million barrel increase in crude stocks. The EIA survey is looking for a 2.5 million barrel drop. But generally, even if we should see those numbers being confirmed, just look at the charts. Just look at the inventory levels of gasoline and distillates. They are well below seasonal averages. Export to Europe is still running at a quite a quite a strong pace because we're missing barrels from Russia. And also what's worth keeping an eye on is really the Finnish motor gas supply. That's basically just an indication of demand in the US. And as you can see, we're basically just bumping along the five-year average right now. We're not yet seeing any slowdown in demand, even though motorists are paying record price at the pumps.
Interesting stuff. All right. Yeah. What point does demand get actually destroyed by these high prices? All right. There's one. There's actually a story I tweeted out on my own Twitter account and on the @SaxoMarketCall Twitter account. I think it's very interesting because we're seeing in the FX space an extension lower in the Japanese yen, and just a bit jarring that we saw this overnight once again. So we saw dollar yen reaching new highs above 133 as we work our way towards that big high from the early 2000s right at 135. And this was despite a pretty solid consolidation lower in treasury yields yesterday. So that's out of sync normally. And you can see on slide 3 on the right-hand side, I showed dollar yen versus the U.S. 10-year treasury benchmark yield. Well, we've seen, you could argue, well, yen crosses should be, or the yen should be generally very offered and very weak when we have global yields marching to new highs for the cycle. So there's that excuse for dollar yen reaching new highs because you're just seeing pressure everywhere on yields higher and at new cycle highs, whereas the U.S. has yet to reach those cycle highs. I just found it specifically interesting that all global yields pretty much consolidated yesterday and yet the yen extended lower. And Q, a great article that emphasized some of the points I've been emphasizing on this whole situation, that at some point the Bank of Japan commitment to yield curve control becomes a little bit like the Swiss National Bank's commitment to that 120 floor in Euro Swiss, maybe with a little bit less volatility. But once the Bank of Japan crumbles on its commitment, either due to an acceptable cost of living increases or because Japanese inflation finally starts to come in higher, a great article. Have a look at that. I agree fully with its points, but there's the angle of speculation here and positioning from Japanese investors that I think is very interesting and has historically driven some very significant Japanese yen volatility. And I suspect that's what's at work here when you're seeing an extension like this lower, despite the lack of fundamental support for the move overnight. And then to round out the point on the left, I'm showing dollar yen versus the 3-month risk reversal for those a little bit more sophisticated knowledge into the options market. That is showing what kind of premium you're paying or discount you're paying for puts and calls in the market, and you're seeing a new high in dollar yen extending, and yet the premium for call options is not extending to new highs. A little bit of divergence there. It's pretty modest. Historically, a dollar yen, though, is generally has a risk reversal that sees puts more highly priced than calls because generally the downside is considered a more volatile scenario because it's correlated with risk appetite, etc., in historic markets. But just an interesting setup. I think when this thing goes at some point, whether it's next week, next month, 3 months from now, or 6 months from now, it will be a spectacular volatility event that has to be respected. The risk of this has to be respected. Just consider it. Consider long-term options plays for yen calls versus a currency of your choice. I think this is a situation that will develop at some point. I think in this calendar year, but it could extend into next year. All right, and then the general FX overview, not really a whole lot else going on. We did see with that risk snapback yesterday in the U.S. equity session, for example, cable, as I show on slide 4, so sterling versus the dollar, also much like the NASDAQ 100, and I do think the sterling is quite sensitive to risk sentiment. After breaking down, it snapped back higher. There was all the kerfuffle about Boris Johnson's leadership vote and as a consequence of this, and to shore up his image with his the party faithful, he's now trying to sort of promise the typical supply side type tax cuts you would need to get more support within the Conservative Party. And Q Chancellor Sunak yesterday promising corporate tax cuts. I'm not sure if this means that they're just not going to increase the tax hikes that are in the pipeline, as they were planning to take the corporate tax rate up to 25% in the UK from the current 19%. There are also some pandemic tax relief for investments that expired in April, but they're trying to promise some supply side tax cuts that are helping, I think, sterling at the margin here. So quite interesting to see that. And really, I think a big test for sterling will be over tomorrow's ECB meeting. All right, let's get back into the swing of things with commodities here. So with this big energy price rise, sea change in energy prices we've seen over the last, let's call it half year, but especially aggravated by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There, long-term bubbling thoughts about the ability of nuclear energy to fill the gap. And you've got some thoughts on uranium on that account, Ole.
Yes, as you can see on slide six, uranium is a very volatile and very roller coaster-like market. We just had a major correction here during between April and May. Now yesterday we saw a jump up 6% if you look at the uranium miner ETF. And the news came after, the jump came after the US administration basically is going to push, ask lawmakers to support a $4.3 billion bill to support production of enriched uranium within the US. The move obviously come with focus on Russia. I think somewhere in the region of 15 to 20% of U.S. Enriched uranium imports come from Russia, and if they should cut off that supply route, that could obviously mean problems for the U.S. Nuclear industry. In addition, this could also be a forerunner to the U.S. Slapping export. Export taxes or ban on Russian uranium. So all in all, we are up 6%, but as you can see, we're well below the peaks that we had both last year and earlier this year. And in the insert, you can see some of the major uranium mining companies. The problem with this suggestion is basically that that the US right now only have one minor producer of enriched uranium. So it would be a major push to get the production up.
Yeah, and then on your next slide, you're talking about Brazil and biodiesel. I've always shaken my head at the whole concept of burning food for fuel. But here we have it. This is not going to exactly help our food supply situation, I imagine.
No, exactly. The November contract, which is the new crop contract, hit a contract high yesterday. And it is basically just the shortage, well, the low inventories we have of fuel stocks around the world is also seen in Brazil. The diesel inventories are running pretty low, and in order to preserve those stocks, they are contemplating increasing the biodiesel or the blend from biodiesel by up towards 15% from the current 10, and that would obviously be a fresh new source of demand for soybeans at a time where obviously China is already a major buyer of Brazilian soybeans. So yeah, it's adding upward pressure to food prices.
All right, and then all this components of inflation. But Peter, I guess your next slide there is a follow up on the discussion yesterday on the one of the sources key sources of inflation being rental inflation, and the perspective being from that Larry Summers Group or Lawrence Summers Group report that actually, if we look at the current one of the current major inflation drivers, that is higher rental prices. And I guess maybe some ideas on how to get exposure to this area.
Yeah, I mean, we just have tremendous amount of clients that are bewildered because everything that worked well for them over the past 5 years, 6 years, I would say, have come to an abrupt end, and they're struggling. That, I mean, we have to think about it. The inflation pressures we're seeing now is within the framework of almost, I would call it a black swan, almost like, I mean, of course, some talked about it, but the idea that inflation was so compressed for 3 decades that almost nobody could think that inflation could come back because there were so many arguments for X, Y, and Z. We had too much debt, we had demographics, there were all these sorts of arguments for why inflation could never come back. And now we have, when you adjust for the changes in the inflation basket, we have the highest inflation rates above the peaks from the 50s and above the peak from the early 70s. So there's only one peak left, and that's the late 70s peak before Volcker really put the brakes on the economy and inflation with a lot of disinflationary policies. So we basically potentially live in this new age of residential inflation because there is a lot of catch up. You mentioned it yesterday, John. We had the biggest increase in U.S. home prices ever, at least according to the measure that we're looking at. And it was up 22%, if I recall, right, in a single
21%,
year.
21%, but yeah,
in that ballpark. And there's quite a considerable lag from higher house prices into these into rent prices because, of course, those two markets have to be in equilibrium because they substitute each other. And so we have a lot of clients that are looking for ways to hedge inflation. And we've just come up in this article, REITs and inflation-linked bonds for the age of inflation. And we've pulled the five largest ETFs, UCITS compliant ETFs here in Europe on the two groups. And I would say, I mean, so just to get the facts quickly, right. So on inflation-linked bonds, they already price inflation. So when do these bonds outperform nominal bonds? They do that when in realized inflation in the future exceeds the expectations that are already priced into the inflation-linked bonds. So that's very important to understand.
Yeah.
The second thing to understand about inflation-linked bonds are that they are issued with a longer maturity than typically most nominal treasury bonds from governments around the world. So you have a higher duration risk. In other words, if interest rates go much higher in a short time span, you will experience that interest rate risk by having the values of the bonds decline. On the REITs, quickly, the inflation-linked bonds were invented in the U.S. and the first one was issued in 1997. So we don't have any experience with high inflation and inflation-linked bonds. That's also a concern, but also the first true test of this asset class. REITs, we had those back in the 70s, and they were a catastrophe. There was a lot of REITs back then that didn't make it through the inflationary period that went bust. A lot of people are arguing that the industry has matured, it's much more robust, the business models are much more firm, yada, yada, yada. That might be true. But what we have seen in some of the subsequent inflationary periods since the peak in the 70s is that REITs have actually done quite well on a relative basis to nominal equities and nominal bonds. So there might be an argument there. There's also no carry cost, which we have on gold. The other point is that a lot of rents are tied to inflation indices. So basically, you at least the cash flow supporting the real estate values are being adjusted upward with inflation. So that was a long spiel, but I think it's important to think about these two components if you set up a portfolio to survive in the age of inflation.
All right, let's look at your next slide of the earnings overview. We don't want to regurgitate every day the same things, but you've got a focus on DocuSign, which is up on tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, it's acquired today. It did take it already reported, better than expected on revenue, mostly due to price hikes and not increases in volume. The profitability was looking okay. They are projecting a stable growth margin for Inditex there. So the next in focus, of course, is tomorrow, DocuSign, Vail Resorts, and Neo. And I think DocuSign is one of the more interesting ones. If you look at it on a quarter-to-quarter basis, you can see that the year-to-year growth rate in revenue is coming down for DocuSign. So the big question is, okay, now that we're knowing that the growth trajectory is coming down fast, can they get the profitability up? Because if they can't, well, it's going to be difficult to support the equity valuation with interest rates and financial conditions on the rise. So that's the battleground. We have seen recently a lot of technology companies in the tier two and tier three layers being able to cut their way to higher earnings surprises and a higher profitability trajectory. So that hopefully is the same case for DocuSign. Hopefully they read the memo from Sequoia Capital to cut marketing expenses as fast as you can, and then subsequently R&D. So we'll see that tomorrow.
Okay, and I don't know if you want to add anything to it, but this interesting report yesterday, or a profit warning from Target. So it's the second profit warning in a short time frame. I actually think the equity recovered quite sharply after another big markdown before the open. And a gap open lower, but it's just interesting, these companies operating in the physical world, they apparently, of course, responded to the incredible increase in demand by stacking up on inventories, and now people are mixed their consumption basket back over to services. It's this crazy sort of pig through a python problem of the stimulus and the shutdowns and the physical world versus the services world. But I wonder, I don't know if you have any thoughts on the operating environment, but just when this situation begins to settle for these companies.
I think it's going to be a tough environment. We know we have a low vaccination rate in China, and we know that they're operating with a different vaccine than we do here in Europe and the US and elsewhere with the mRNA. I think it's one of the biggest downside risks to the economy. And to inflation, in that case, it would be the upside risk. But I think that I think there's a considerable risk that China could swing into new lockdowns when we get into the fall and the winter period. I really hope I'm wrong on that, but I think it is a risk you can't you should consider it, and that would be put more pressure on retailers. So, and I think the reason why the market took the target surprise, John, in strides was because, you know, at the end of the day, you already had so many retailers cutting their outlook. So I think a lot of the bearishness were already priced in the entire industry.
Yeah, it has suffered quite a markdown already. Target certainly has, after a big pump up post pandemic outbreak. All right, let's look at the calendar for today and for the rest of the week. So today, pretty light on data. The Hungarian CPI was actually out slightly before we recorded this. Interesting to see the impact there. I wonder if they're underreporting a little bit. And I think there's risk, a forward risk of very high inflation in Hungary with the big rise in wages. I've covered that topic before. In OLA space, we have the weekly crude oil and stock reports, fuel stock reports from the EIA. A Polish rate announcement, they're expected to hike again to 6% for the policy rate. And then a 10-year treasury auction after yesterday's three-year auction saw a bit more tepid demand than the prior auction did. And foreign bidders stepping away to a degree. But it should be very important to this one. We're right pinned right around 3% on the 10-year benchmark yield and that big 3.25% cycle high, and basically the high from late 2018 also somewhat in view here. Tomorrow, the ECB, we're looking for the guidance there. They're very thoroughly flagged that they're going to be winding down QE and will be doing a July liftoff, overwhelming likelihood for a 25 basis point move there. But the market is sort of uncertain on whether they could go bigger thereafter in terms of the size of the rate hikes. We'll be looking at the inflation forecast in particular for the new staff projections there. So the first refresh of those since March. And then the May CPI of the U.S. on Friday, the big data point from the U.S. this week ahead of the FOMC meeting, of course, next Wednesday. All right, let's call it a wrap for today, and we'll see how things stand tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.